والفضل والإنعام الذي بعد فلا يرى وقرب فشهد النجوى.
In our case, this occupation with something of concern is yearning and longing for the Almighty Allah. Therefore, these two elements, wakefulness and sleeplessness, represent two states among the states of love, intimacy and yearning. Intimacy with the remembrance of Allah and His presence, such that the servant feels the presence of Allah in his supplication. And at the same time, yearning for meeting with Allah. In fact, a lover experiences both these states when he stands before Allah. Now, let's consider this fact, that sleeping is a human need, and each of the righteous and the wicked have their share of it. Even the prophets and the truthful ones do sleep, they have to sleep. But there's a difference between one who takes from sleep to the extent of his need, the way he fulfills his need from eating and drinking, and between one who surrenders himself to sleep and is dominated by it. As for the friends of the Almighty Allah, they do not surrender themselves to sleep. Rather, sleep is a need for them, and they only take their share from it, not more. The Holy Prophet ﷺ did not use to sleep but a little in order to be able to stand before Almighty Allah. Even his sleep was aimed towards standing before the Almighty Allah. He ﷺ used to order for the water of ablution, or wudu, to be kept at his head so that he may stand before Allah every time after he had taken his share from his natural need. A soft and comfortable mattress would be spread for him, but he ordered to take this away, lest it should gradually lead him to submit to sleep. Instead, he would sleep on a rough mat such that would leave an impression on his side.
Why do we make supplication? And why do we call out to Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala? Is it because God is not aware of our needs? God is Al-Alim. He knows all of our needs. Is it because God needs convincing? God is known as Al-Jawad. He is the source of generosity. Then why am I making dua to Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala? The dua is a journey of realizations. When a person goes to the ocean and he takes with him a bucket that can carry 4 liters of water, the ocean is infinite. In as much as your vessel is large, that is the amount of water that the ocean will give you. And therefore, our goal is to expand our capacity. Rumi has a very beautiful poem. He says, "Har khujo mushkil javab onjo ravad." Wherever there is a problem, that is where the answer will come. Wherever there is a vessel, that's where the water will come. Don't go seeking for water. Instead, create the thirst within you. So that the water may burst forth from above and from below you. Experience that realization that you need God, and the mercy of God will come towards you.
Paradise, thank you, Allah. Now that we're here, feeling so good about all the things that we went through, knowing that God is pleased with us too. It's not a dream, this is so true, and we know we'll be here forever.
The ocean of dua.
You may have heard that in our traditions and narrations, they say that the Almighty Allah has placed in the calmness of the night the treasures of His whispered prayers, remembrance and proximity, which cannot be found in the daytime. The night has its own men, as the day has its own. They stand in prayers when people are asleep. They get zealous and lively when people are dull. They ascend toward Allah when people submit themselves to sleep and fall into their beds. And the Holy Prophet was the man of both the night and the daytime. He utilized both of them in a kind of equal proportion. That is because awliyaullah are the ones who make the most of what they're given. Thank you, dear listeners, for staying with us in this program. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Thank you, dear listeners of IRIB English, for listening to us. If you have any question regarding our programs, feel free to email us at englishradio@irib.ir. Also, visit our website at parstoday.com. Until the next program, take care and goodbye. Allah.
Before Mohammed bin Salman came to power as the Saudi crown prince and the de facto leader of the kingdom in 2017, he established a charity by the name of MISC, or Prince Mohammed bin Salman bin Abdulaziz Foundation, a non-profit foundation with the stated goal of cultivating and encouraging learning and leadership in youth for a better future in Saudi Arabia. MISC was in fact central to the so-called MBS project, aimed at promoting bin Salman as a compassionate leader who cares for the well-being of others. Much to the dismay of the young crown prince, MISC is now engulfed in a spate of scandals, including the Khashoggi hit. The foundation came under suspicion following a lawsuit filed in the U.S. last November, according to which MISC's former Secretary General, Badr al-Assakr, had interactions with two former Twitter employees, namely Ali al-Zabara and Ahmed Abu Amr, both accused of spying on private user data of some Saudi dissidents and passing it to Riyadh. The suit asserted that al-Assakr had provided gifts, cash payments, and promises of future employment in exchange for non-public information about Twitter users. The two employees, along with Ahmed al-Mutairi, who then worked for the Saudi royal family, tapped data from 6,000 Twitter accounts in the years 2014 and 2015. The aim was to identify, and needless to say, to punish some of the Saudi dissidents who would criticize the kingdom's ruling family on the social media platform. The three men all worked for Asakar, who was back then in charge of Bin Salman's charity foundations, with a small fortune in his pocket. But that was not the first and last time Asakar, who still continues to have a senior role at MISC, hit the headlines for his non-philanthropic work. Just a few weeks after the killing of Jamal Khashoggi, the Turkish newspaper Yeni Safak ran the story that the Saudi intelligence officer at the Saudi consulate in Istanbul called Asakar four times the day Khashoggi was killed.
Mohammed bin Salman is not only the absolute ruler of Saudi Arabia, meaning that he controls everything from the functions of the state to murders that are carried out, assassinations that are carried out, to the charitable trust. And we shouldn't be surprised at all that he is still busy trying to brutally murder people. Mohammed bin Salman has not been held accountable in any way for the murder of Jamal Khashoggi, and we're right now at the anniversary of that.
Critics say beneath the surface of MISC and gentle appearance of its former Secretary General, who happens to head bin Salman's private office, lie dark secrets that dovetail with the Saudi Crown Prince's real image, not the one burnished by his spin doctors. In the words of director of Freedom Forward, Sanjeev Berry, the Crown Prince and his henchmen keep trying to present themselves in a positive light. Yet behind the scenes, they spy on dissidents' Twitter accounts and are willing to take a bone saw to anyone who disagrees with them. Initially, a number of big names like the United Nations, the Gates Foundation, Bloomberg, Harvard University, and General Electric sealed partnerships with MISC. But in the wake of the Khashoggi killing, more of them, like the Gates Foundation and Harvard University, cut ties with it.
Mohammed bin Salman, since he came into power, has been trying to sell us an image of himself, like a Disney World version of a Saudi crown prince, one who is a reformer, one who is bringing his country into the modern era. But in reality, he is a brutal dictator who has created the worst humanitarian crisis on the planet in Yemen, who chops up the bodies of journalists, who imprisons women for speaking out against him, or for speaking out, calling for their rights. And so, you know, he's trying to present this Disneyland image, but especially after Khashoggi's murder and looking at heroes like Lujain al-Haqloul, who remains imprisoned in Saudi Arabia, we easily see through him, see through this image, and see him for the brutal, bone-saw, misogynist dictator that he is.
The scandalous story of MISC reached its crescendo in August this year, when former Saudi intelligence officer Saad al-Jabri filed a lawsuit in the U.S., alleging that the Saudi crown prince plotted to assassinate him by sending a 50-person kill team, dubbed the Tiger Squad, a few weeks after the killing of Khashoggi. According to al-Jabri, MISC conspired with Asakar and bin Salman to covertly recruit individuals to serve as agents and who participated in the hunt for him on U.S. and Canadian soil. The hitmen were offered employment at MISC as a reward for aiding the Crown Prince and Mr. Al-Sakar. Concerns about the so-called charitable foundation intensified in September 2017, when people from MISC repeatedly asked one of Jabri's sons for contact details of Jabri himself and his wife, as well as about their residency status in the United States.
Mohammed bin Salman is trying to paint himself as this modernizer, as this reformer, we are continuing to expose the Saudi regime for the brutal dictatorship that it is, for the war crimes that it commits. Saudi Arabia this year is hosting the G20 forum, but across the board, mayors of cities across America and across the world who have been invited are canceling. And they are canceling because of the imprisoned women, because of the brutal crackdowns on journalists, on dissidents, because of the brutal war in Yemen.
The Miss case begs this question. If Saudi officials can run spy rings, dismember a journalist, and dispatch a kill team all under the guise of a charity, what can they not do in an all-out military conflict like the Yemen war? Whether these are just the tip of the iceberg or not, MISC Foundation, first and foremost, embodies the Saudi duplicity entrenched in the kingdom's ruling family, where things are not really what they seem.
Insights into the Holy Quran.
Indeed, this Quran guides to what is most upright and gives the good news to the faithful who do righteous deeds, that there is a great reward for them.
In the name of Allah, the Compassionate, the Merciful, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, Assalamu Alaikum. Welcome to another edition of the program, Insights into the Holy Quran by Sayyid Muhammad Hassan Mudarrisi, a graduate of the Hawza Seminary of Qom. Please stay with us.
أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم الحمد لله رب العالمين ثم الصلاة والسلام على سيدنا محمد وآله الطاهرين. In the name of Allah, the most beneficent, the most merciful. Hello everyone, dear brothers and sisters. I am Sayyid Muhammad Hassan Mudarrisi, and we're going to be with you with another edition of Insights into the Holy Quran. And in this edition of the program, we'll discuss the 22nd chapter of the Holy Quran, Surah Al-Hajj, or Pilgrimage. Before moving on, let's just listen to some verses of this chapter, and we'll be back with you. Stay with us.
Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim.
In the name of Allah, the entirely merciful, the especially merciful.
Al-Mulku Yawma Idhin Lillahi Yahya.
أم بينهم
الَّذِينَ آمَنُوا وَعَمِلُوا الصَّالِحَاتِ فِي جَنَّاتِ النَّعِيمِ.
All sovereignty that day is for Allah. He will judge between them. So they who believed and did righteous deeds will be in gardens of pleasure.
Dear listeners, in the previous program, we talked about the 55th verse of the chapter, and we concluded that being in doubt forever will lead to aberration, and the result is nothing but chastisement of a barren day. And the reason why it's called the barren day might be is that it leaves no chance for making up and compensation. But in this verse, the 56th one, the Holy Quran says, الْمُلْكُ يَوْمَئِذٍ لِلَّهِ. On that day, the sovereignty will be Allah's. يَحْكُمُ بَيْنَهُمْ. He will judge between them. فَالَّذِينَ آمَنُوا وَعَمِلُوا الصَّالِحَاتِ فِي جَنَّاتِ النَّعِيمِ. And those who believe and do righteous deeds will be in gardens of bliss. So in this part, the Holy Quran is pointing to the absolute sovereignty of the Almighty Allah on that day, the day of resurrection. And it says, الْمُلْكُ يَوْمَئِذٍ لِلَّهِ. On that day, the sovereignty will be Allah's. This, of course, does not allocate to the resurrection day, because today and always the absolute sovereignty belongs to Allah. Yet, since there are some other kinds of owners and rulers who count themselves actually as owners and true rulers in this world too, there may arise this thought that there are some rulers and owners other than Allah. But on the day of hereafter, where all these matters are absent, this fact will be made manifest more than any other times, and all will understand that the true ruler and owner is only the one Almighty Allah. And of course, it cannot be taken into consideration, this ownership of this world. The realm of the authorities in this world is really limited and weak. But anyway, on that day, there will be no one thinking other than the Almighty Allah. And it should be noted and taken into account that the criterion of Allah's judgment on the day of hereafter will be the belief and disbelief of human beings. يَحْكُمُ بَيْنَهُمْ. He will judge between them. فَالَّذِينَ آمَنُوا وَعَمِلُوا الصَّالِحَاتِ فِي جَنَّاتِ النَّعِيمِ. Those who believe, and of course based on this belief, did the righteous deeds, فِي جَنَّاتِ النَّعِيمِ, will be in the gardens of bliss. This is one part of the judgment of the Almighty Allah. The second part, of course, will be said in the next verse, وَالَّذِينَ كَفَرُوا وَكَذَّبُوا بِآيَاتِنَا. But we will talk about that later on.
We hope and pray that Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala blesses us with the ability to cover more of His divine
word. In this series of programs, we will inshallah discuss the Holy Quran with a thematic approach.
We will inshallah discuss the chapter.
وتمثل القرآن في أخلاقه وفعاله فيه الفؤاد تعلقا وتلاه في جنح الدجى متدبرا.
The context in which Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala speaks in this verse is the context of mentioning the ills and problems and evils of the people of the book, the previous nations who have received revelation, and more particularly the Jew.
Now let's listen to some of the verses of the Holy Quran.
First, let's listen to a few verses.
Now let's listen to some verses of the Holy Quran.
أنتم الفقراء.
Insights into the Holy Quran. By Sayyid Muhammad Hassan Mudarrisi, a graduate of the Hawza Seminary of Qom.
We talked about the judgment of the Almighty Allah, criterion of that, and we concluded that Al-Mulku Yawma Idhin Lillah means on that day the sovereignty will be Allah's. Means there are two kinds of sovereignties and ownerships. The first is the true sovereignties, which is the sovereignty of creator over the creatures. And the second is the nominal and conventional sovereignty, which is current among the usual people. But what is important is that these two both exist in this world, but in hereafter, all the nominal, all the conventional sovereignties will be dismissed, and there will remain only the true sovereignty of the creator of the worlds. However, since the true owner is Allah, he will be the true ruler too. Anyway, he will govern over and judge between all human beings, whether they are believers or disbelievers. The consequence of which is the same thing that the Holy Quran has stated at the end of this holy verse. It says, فَالَّذِينَ آمَنُوا وَعَمِلُوا الصَّالِحَاتِ فِي جَنَّاتِ النَّعِيمِ. Those who believe and do righteous deeds will be in gardens of bliss. So, you may have understood up to now that at first it says آمَنُوا and then it says عَمِلُوا الصَّالِحَاتِ. Means doing righteous deeds cannot happen unless you have a firm belief and thought beforehand. Since the verse says Allahu yahkumu baynahum, the Almighty Allah will judge between them, and they will be of two groups. The first group were the believers, the ones who were doing the righteous deeds. The end of these people will be the gardens of bliss. The next group we will talk about, inshallah, in the later program with the 57th verse. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Don't be saddened by what you see, by all the lies and treachery. Life is cruel, but don't worry. In your heart lies the key to unwind all the secrets. This life we see.
Thank you, dear listeners of IRIB English, for listening to us. If you have any question regarding our programs, feel free to email us at englishradio@irib.ir. Also, visit our website at parsetoday.com. Until the next program, take care.
Things always worked for me. Why ends when faith begins?
Fruitful Moments with IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Lecture.
Sheikh Asad Ja'fari.
Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. Ya ayyuhalladhina amanu qu anfusakum wa ahlikum nara. Sallu ala Muhammad wa ali Muhammad. Achieving a life of bliss through the Islamic family has been our ongoing topic. Our discussion has been revolving around the difficulties and challenges that we are facing today within our own Islamic families, and attempting to convert our houses into homes, attempting to, of course, create that level of sukoon, itminan, serenity, and comfort inside the homes that was meant to be there. And our discussion was revolving around a tradition by Imam Ja'far al-Sadiq alayhi salatu wasalam, where, as I've mentioned the past nights, and I'll keep repeating myself until it gets through all of us, he mentions that ubudiyah, subservience to Allah, is not possible without four different relationships to be examined by every individual. And I chose this specific tradition because I see a pattern developing sometimes inside of our homes, inside of our communities, where we, you know, some of us feel like as long as I am good with Allah and I'm upholding my personal responsibility with Allah, it doesn't quite matter how I am with everything else. He talks about the idea that you and Allah, you and others, you and the dunya, you and your a'mal, are those four relationships that we should constantly examine. And in light of our topic that we have chosen, I have examined the idea of you and others, and here others being, of course, your family. The four of you, the five of you, the two of you, the six of you, however many family members you have, inside your four walls. We talked about the fact that with every four relationships, there are seven respective principles for each relationship. The first two being hilm and afw, forbearance and forgiveness. As I promised, we'll discuss all seven and two more tonight. Tawazur and sakhawat, humility and generosity. And it's important that we understand these seven are meant to be applied inside of our homes. Humility is a basic akhlaqi conduct of behavior inside of us. And now this is where the battle begins now, between your environment inside the home and the environment outside. Now, I'm not against social media. You guys know that about me. I'm not against social media. But ask yourself, is it creating something inside of me that wasn't there years ago? If I become so self-absorbed, the thought of doing something for others without recognition is unheard of. What do you mean by that? Now, tomorrow we talk about shafqat, compassion. Tomorrow we talk about, inshallah. And there you'll understand, to my youth, you'll understand the path that your parents made from their respective countries to come here with immigration is a path that you and I could never travel, ever travel. That's tomorrow's discussion. Because why? They did it for who? For everybody but themselves. They were comfortable where they were. Good job, their family, their culture, their language. Nobody to bully them. No one to mock their English. No one to mock the color of their skin. No taxis to drive. No this to that. Nothing. All they were set in their countries. They did it for the sake of their own children. That sense of doing something outside of yourself has not quite come into my generation. It's all about you, do you, bro. Why? Because I can. Why? Because I can. And that's all it is. It's all about me, me, me generation. And we have to raise kids today. It's not about me. The deen is all about communal. The deen is about a community. The deen is about outside of you. Why is Shahada the highest level inside of Islam? Because imagine now, you sacrifice every drop of your breath for something outside of you. For a mission outside of you. For a creator outside of you. You get nothing. In fact, you go through torture. But there's a bigger cause that you're after, which is outside of you. I ask my youth today, travel outside yourselves once in a while. Do things because it's the right thing to do. Our first imam says, what's better than the amal khair is the doer of the amal khair. Why? Because he's doing it or she's doing it because it's the right thing to do. Sometimes you simply have to do things because that's what society needs at that moment. If that means that you're not recognized, it's okay. It's all right. It doesn't always have to be about how does it affect me or elevate me or how does it benefit me. We can remove the me out of it and leave what's good and khair. We need to start raising selfless children. This society will do its part to talk about the idea that, look, individual, individual, individual. Let nobody force you to believe in anything. Don't tell anyone that, you know, don't let anyone tell you you can't love that person or marry that person or go here or drink that or eat this or go here. You are your own master. And the deen is trying to remind us that you are nothing but a slave to that master. The faster you realize that, the higher you'll go towards him. Sallu ala Muhammad wa ala Muhammad. Now, I'm not saying that this idea of self-worth is not important. All of you have heard my lectures, I'm sure, 1,000 times. You know that I talk about the idea between self-worth and self-worship. The very, very fine body climb between the two. Right? Khud pasandi and khud parasi, as they say in Farsi. Islam talks about you should have self-worth. Islam does not say for you to be zaleel in front of the human being, no. But you should not have so much self-worth that you begin to worship yourself. We talk about but parasti and idol worshipping back in the Jahil era of the Holy Prophet. Almost as if it is a forgotten phenomenon. But Rumi says that the mother of all idols is the self. Have we begun or have we stopped worshipping ourselves? It's very, very difficult. When our fourth imam says a dua, a beautiful dua, and then I'll move towards my second point. He says, Allah, when somebody elevates me outside of me, lower me that much more inside of me. Oh. Why? Just to balance it out. Pick up khutbah muttaqeen, khutbah hammam, 193 Nahj al-Balagha. Mullah Ali talks about this, one of the signs of the pious is what? That when somebody praises them on the outside, they beg to Allah. Allah, they don't know me like you know me. Forgive me for those mistakes that they haven't seen. I mean, what? They don't get happy. They don't sit there and get their chest out. They're humble toward in front of Allah. And Allah, if they know about me what you know about me, they will not say a word to me. Let's try to inject this sense of humility inside of us. Understand that you are a creation, that everything that we have comes from Allah. He's always given us more than we deserve. That's without any discussion. But it is based on His compassion and love, not based on His adalat and His fairness or His justice. He's always given us more than what we deserve. Take that and build this sense of tawazu inside of you. Serve those causes outside of you. Why? It's the right thing to do. Sallu ala Muhammad wa ala Muhammad. The fourth principle is sakhawat, to be sakhi in Islam, generosity, to be generous in Islam. I touched on it a little bit, I believe, in the first discussion, but let me just expand on it a little bit. What is true generosity in Islam? I'll tell you what it's not. What it's not, the ulama say, is to give to those who ask for it. It's very easy to give to those who ask. Somebody comes to you and says, I need this, you have it, you give it, that's done, khalas. That's not sakhawat. Yeah, it's good to do that. You help a brother out, that's great, fantastic. Nothing wrong with it. But true generosity is to give to somebody in need before they ask. Now you know, and I wish that this culture was inside of our communities, and it's not, unfortunately. But sometimes a lot of you know other members in your community that are struggling. Maybe they lost a job and they're in a field that you're in. Maybe you know that inside their homes there are some domestic issues. Or maybe you just see the fact that this was a man who was happy-go-lucky, always laughing, always smiling. You know, milansar, going salam to everybody. But he's been lately very quiet, very reserved. He comes late, he leaves early. And I wish we had that culture. And maybe we do, I don't know. We can stop someone and say, look, you haven't been yourself lately. Or I heard that you lost your job. Let me grab your resume and do the best that I can to get you a job. I've heard that you and Bobby are having some issues. What if me and wife came over and just had a cup of tea with you guys? Maybe we could talk a little bit about it. Now, they might say, mind your own business. They might say, you know, don't worry about it, I got it. They might say, you know, thank you very much. You might be worried about their pride. But I'm saying that there's a higher good to that. There's a bigger good to that. And that is the idea that we need to really work together as a family unit in the community. To come and to bring people towards this sense of itminan inside their lives. Especially if you know people who are struggling. But you know, I don't wanna pry Milana, I don't wanna get too involved, you know, he might be upset. All I'm saying is open the door a crack. If they come in, alhamdulillah. If they don't, you've done your part. You know, Imam Ali would describe the Holy Prophet as a walking physician. It's a beautiful way to describe the Holy Prophet. That he would walk and he would pick up symptoms from people before they would even know they had those symptoms. And give them the nuskha, and give him the prescription, and give him the dawa and the medication before they would come and say, Ya Rasulullah, I need this. Because some people will not come and ask you. Out of pride, out of tawakkul, whatever you want to call it, some people will carry on with their very miserable life because they don't want to lower themselves asking for help. It shouldn't be the case. Now we think that the idea of generosity is financial. It's not, as all of you know. Charity, sadaqah, could be everything from a smile, to a text, to a phone call, to financial. And sometimes it's also in your words. Surah Isra, the very famous Uf verse that we have against our parents, where Allah says, وَقَضَى رَبُّكَ أَلَّا تَعْبُدُ إِلَّا إِيَّاهُ وَبِالْوَالِدَيْنِ أَحْسَانًا. Right? It's a hukum from Allah that you don't worship anybody but Him, and you are good to your parents. And then it goes on to say, very specifically, that when your parents, one of them, reach an older age, a lot of you care for your parents when they're a little bit older. When they're a little bit older. Now, when they're a little bit older, their demands are a little bit higher. And you're working full-time, or your spouse is working full-time, it becomes very difficult sometimes. And I've seen so of you, that frustration lies in. And sometimes we end up saying things. And the Quran says that you are not. لا تقول لهم أفن. You are not to say أف to them. Now أف is not a word in Arabic. أف is not a word. أف is a expression of frustration, as the ulama beautifully described it. An expression of frustration. The sighs and the soos and the haws and the stomping of the stairs, the slamming of doors and the throwing of pillows. That's all أف. Sometimes we do with our parents. We're not even allowed to do that. Instead, the Quran says, وَقُولْ لَهُمَا قَوْلًا كَرِيمًا. When you speak to them in a call that's generous. Meaning what? You talk to them before they even ask you what they need from you. Now, it's about parents that are older. I'll take it towards our homes. Sometimes I know parents, they come to me and say, Milana, he's changed. She's changed. She used to be so happy and go lucky. Skipping around the house. She would cook us breakfast on Saturday, for example. She'd go for walks with us, let's say, for example. Now, doesn't say a word. Doesn't smile at me. Inside of her room all day. She's always stuck to her device. And I don't know what to do. And sometimes the behavior of your kids inside your home, they're screaming at you to come and help me without them actually saying, Mom and Dad, I need help. either one, they don't think that you can help them, or number two, they don't want to bother you and stress you out. Why don't you tell your mother and your father, I don't want to stress them out, Malala. They're already stressed about finances, about job, about health, blah, blah, blah. My 16-year-old problems, I don't want to stress them out. Before they could even ask for you, generosity says what? Approach them as a mother and father. Say, look, you're not yourself, lady. What's going on? That's not Hamos Mizaj. That's not a quiet child. He converted somewhere. He changed somewhere. He went from, you know, never leaving the living room to always being in his room. We have to be generous in our goal, in our speech, when it comes to inside the home. Open dialogue, open communication. If you say, look, I've tried, and she just says, I'm fine, don't worry about me, then keep trying through different means. But let her feel, or let him feel inside your home, that, you know what, my parents care about me. They're actually picking up behavioral patterns from me. They're worried about me. I mentioned acknowledgement. It's important that our kids feel like they're acknowledged inside the home. Imagine, if you will, that somebody walks into this hall now, and you're sitting having chai with a group of your friends, and a person comes to your circle, says salam to everybody, and skips over you. Just imagine for a moment. The next day, the next majlis, again, the same idea, same circle, same chai, again, he skips over you. After three times, you'll say, Baba, come here. Is everything okay? You're not seeing me? Are you upset at me? No, why? You won't even say salam to me. Everyone else you said salam to. I mean, sometimes we are that sensitive about acknowledgement. The biggest complaint sometimes that our elders have to me is that, can you teach these kids at least say salam when you walk into the building? Fine, you don't know me, but I'm your elder. At least come and say salam, uncle. How are you, auntie? Everything well? No, they don't do that. Head down, angry face. They come and sit inside the hall. Why? Acknowledgement is huge. And there's nothing better than salamun alaykum as an acknowledgement. It's not even a greeting, it's a dua, is it not? Absolutely. That not only do I acknowledge you, but I acknowledge you with a dua that may peace be unto you. When somebody would speak to the Holy Prophet in his peripheral, let's say for example, he would physically turn towards them. And his eye into their eye, if they're mahram. Meaning what? At that moment, all that matters to me is what you're saying to me. Nothing else matters. These are small things, my brothers and my sisters. Very, very small things, but they carry a lot of weight inside of today's kids. You know, they're talking to us. We're like, yeah, I know. We don't even turn around to even face them. If a child does not feel acknowledged inside the home, he'll look for that acknowledgement outside the home. Or she will look for that acknowledgement outside the home. And that's where we've lost our children. If they go searching for their verification and their validation outside the home. Sakhawat and generosity is not writing a check. It's to make the person feel like you are a huge portion of this home. If you have children, where you have one that's 11, 12, 14, 15, and the others are small, for example, there has to be a difference in your tarbiyah. And that's my discussion on Saturday. Adal and Insaf is the seventh principle. I'll look at that. But one small trick that is really important for us to understand is that when some of our parents are planning big moves, for example, either a Hajj trip or a vacation or ziyarat, or to actually move into a different house, and you have meetings and you talk about it, the ulama of akhlaq say that when you have someone who's older inside your home, bring them into that meeting. Say, look, it's me, it's you, and it's your mother. The other siblings of yours are too small. You're mashallah old now. You want to move. What do you think about this move? You'd be surprised that 15-year-olds are very smart nowadays. They'll tell you what area is booming, what area has good value, you know, where the homes are, you know, this has a mall area, that's close to the airport, blah, blah, blah. And then you assign them responsibility. Or you say, look, this is where I want to go, find the best flight for me. This kid will sit there and he'll search, he'll find the flight in one day for you. Baba, I got a great deal for you. That's all great. It's a minute task, finding a flight. But now what you're doing is that Baba, not only did he give me responsibility, he trusted me with this job. And he applied whatever I gave him. Small things, I tell you. But that child now feels like I belong inside the home. That's the sakhawat we need inside of our home. Allow your kids to feel like they're a presence inside the home. Like they're acknowledged inside the home. If that means that you wait extra 10 minutes and then come home to have a meal, do that. And let him know that, look, we were going to start, but we want to eat with you. So come and sit with us and eat. It sends a huge message for us. Now you try all that and still, then that's fine. You've done your best. But try it. Acknowledgement at the age of 16 is a very, very big deal. Sallu ala Muhammad wa ala Muhammad. So two principles today, humility and generosity. Tawazu and sakhawat, both of them. We have to begin to apply these tonight into our home, inshallah. And understand what it means to be a family of humility, a family of generosity. You can go, let's say, for example, and help out a charity together as a family, what better? You can go, let's say, for example, and work on each other's humbleness, then what better? Those are families that, of course, will begin to elevate towards Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. Sallu ala Muhammad wa ala Muhammad. The shahadat of Sayyidah Fatima. It's a very difficult masail. It's a musibah, it's a dhulm that we will never forget, we don't want to forget. What the ummah did to her after the Holy Prophet's death is unforgettable. And if you examine her last few moments of her life, her sense of selflessness, her sense of a greater cause, her sense of removing herself from the equation and looking at what the greater good is incredible. Even in her pain, she wouldn't forget that concept, those realities that were outside of her. After the Holy Prophet's death, after Saqifah happened, there was chaos in Medina. There are people who are walking around Medina with their shirt tied around their waist, their sword in their hand, forcing bay'ah to whoever was listening. And besides a handful of the Bani Hashim, there were others who would very, very easily give bay'ah to the first Khalifa. Either out of fear of the sword, let's say for example, or the idea and the concept that maybe they didn't understand what Ghadir was. I don't know. But when the realization happened, there was the khas few of the Bani Hashim, in there included was Amir al-Mu'mineen, did not give bay'ah to the first Khalifa, then the second Khalifa made it his mission to somehow make it a point for Ali to give bay'ah to the first Khalifa. Now I want you to understand the pain of Amir al-Mu'mineen, not only his physical pain, not only the grief of his wife, but sometimes, you know, these pinching comments that sometimes we hear in history. When the first Khalifa would send individuals to summon Imam Ali towards him to give bay'at, the first man goes to Imam Ali and says, Ali, the Khalifa of your time has summoned you for bay'at. And Imam Ali says that I don't accept his khilaf. Sometimes we think that Ali, Imam Ali was quiet. He was not quiet enough. He expressed his pain in different forms. Pick up Khutbah Sheikh Shaqiyah. You read the pain of Amir al-Mu'mineen, describing the Khilafat as a shirt. That a man has forced his shirt on himself. It's not his shirt. It doesn't fit him. It's obvious it's not his shirt. But he's taken it forcefully and tried to, of course, force it onto himself. Or he says that the old have died off, the young have become old. I'm still waiting for my God to give a right to be given back to me. If I pull out my Zulfiqar and I fight for that Khilafat, then they'll say Ali is greedy of power. If I put the Zulfiqar back, they'll say that I am fearful of death. painful. When he rejects the first individual, the first Khalifa sends another individual to summon Amir al-Mu'mineen. And this time the gall now, this man says, Ali, Amir al-Mu'mineen is summoning you to give bay'at to his khalifa. Using the laqab of Amir al-Mu'mineen, which is khas and only, faqat only for Imam Ali, is painful for Ali. Again, he says, I don't accept. And he moves and he makes his way towards the house. Word gets back to the first Khalifa that he's not accepting his invitation for bayat. If I had more time, I would go into the history. I don't have more time. Enough to know that that outraged those around the first Khalifa. Made them very angry. Their Khilafat would not have been solidified without the bayat of Imam Ali. And they knew that. We can get Ali to give bay'ah to the first Khalifa, and that's it. That's all we want. They were obsessed with that bay'ah. The same obsession we saw with Yazid. He was told by his father Muawiyah, look, I'm making you successor, you are the Khalifa. Now, don't ask Husayn ibn Ali for bay'ah. Let him be in Medina. But Yazid knew that my Khilafat meant nothing until the Bani Hashim and the Ahlul Bayt came and they would give bay'ah to him. First person he asked for bay'at was Husayn ibn Ali. The same obsession happened here as well. Now this anger now converts into the idea that they gather some men, they gather some wood, and they show up at the door of Allah. That door that the angels would ask for permission to enter through that. That door that 6 months after the revelation of Ayat al-Tathir, the Prophet would go to the door of Fatima, Salamu alayka ya Ahl Bayt al-Nabuwa. That door. They arrived at that door, banging on that door. Send Ali out, he has to give bay'at. Send Ali out, he has to give bay'at. And the one to answer that door was Fatima. The lone defender of the wilayat of Amir al-Mu'mineen. The lone defender. She physically stood there between them and Amir al-Mu'mineen. And she would say, so long as I am here, Ali will not come out for bayat. When the claim came that we will burn the house down, it does not come out. It was not the idea that we will burn the door down. No, very clear. We will burn the house down. From Sheikh Abbas Qummi to Tabarisi to everybody has narrated the idea that the motive of bringing that much wood to the house was to burn the actual house down. And when somebody in that group mentioned to him that, look, Fatima is in that house. Small children are in that house. The response is, I don't care. Bangs on the door, and still no response. Imam Ali is not coming out. I don't know if you have seen the homes of that era, but still, like that, some homes still exist inside of Iran. You open the front door of a house, you can't see inside the house. You go a little bit, then there's a wall. And then that wall, there's a door. That door leads inside the actual home. Such that if somebody was to open the door by mistake, they can't see all the non-mahram women inside the house. So again, I want you to imagine now for a moment that Fatima is behind the door. Behind her is a wall. There's a door there that leads inside the home. On that side,